Well, as we gather together this morning, we gather, unless you really have been in extreme quarantine, you know that we're in times of somewhat uncertainty and there's plenty of fear to go around. And the question in times of uncertainty and fear is, how do you proceed? That really is before us in this psalm, but it comes to us even as a congregation. You know, do we cancel worship? And if we don't, what are we to do? As a church, at least in the leadership of this church, we want to at least address this in a twofold manner. You know, we want to attend to our charge and be faithful in the things that we have instructed you in over the years, saying these things are important to us, important to your spiritual health and well-being, things like corporate worship and the preached word and sacraments, that we want those things to continue. And at the same time, we also want to be wise to love you as a congregation, but also for all of us to love our neighbors by not unnecessarily becoming, more dangerous than we need to be as far as spreading, a disease. And so in those two desires, a desire to put an emphasis on what we have stated is important to us as a church, and a desire to be wise, we have to ask what means will we use, to try to accomplish these things. Some things will change, in how we handle services until such a time as we feel it's safe to proceed with business as usual. And if it turns out that our particular area, the Temecula Valley, becomes more of a high-risk area than it currently is, we will likely implement more changes to hopefully ensure your safety as best we are able, humanly speaking, and also the safety of our broader community, by heeding whatever protocols are instructed to us that will somehow lessen the likelihood of exposure. When situations like this arise, which are not new to the history of mankind, but are somewhat new to us because we've lived that blessed of a life. I mean, if you think of that, it's a pretty wild concept. There are usually two categories of people. There are more, but it's a lot easier to just talk about two types. There are the concerned and afraid as one category. And sometimes that concern and fear, borders on panic. Some have crossed the border of panic and they've taken all the toilet paper with them, apparently. And then there are the unconcerned and somewhat dismissive, and they can border on being dangerous and risky. You saw that even highlighted this week with Rudy Gobert of the NBA when he tested positive on Thursday after on Monday during a press conference, he touched all the microphones and the recording equipment of the media as a way to kind of mock the idea of the coronavirus. And then he's 4 days later diagnosed as the first NBA player with coronavirus. As Luther put it when writing a fellow minister during a time of plague, he said that we are in danger of committing two sins in times like this, sins of the right hand and sins of the left. Left-handed sins for Luther were sins of weakness. Those who through fear end up sinning in ways that undermine their Christian faith. And he says, whoever wants to serve Christ in person should surely serve his neighbor as well. This is said as an admonition and encouragement against fear and disgraceful flight to which the devil would tempt us to, so that we should disregard God's command in our dealings with our neighbor and so would fall into sin on the left hand. And what he meant by that was that we've all been called to certain vocations, whether it be as, ministers and elders or city officials or parents or workers and so forth. And he says, if your fear of a particular disease so wraps you that you end up dropping your duties, those duties that you owe to your neighbor in order to only protect yourself, he said those are sins of weakness or sins of the left hand. Sorry for you left-handed people. But he said there are right-handed sins as well, sins of strength. And he says, quote, others sin on the right hand, they are much too rash and reckless, tempting God and disregarding everything which might counteract death and the plague. They disdain the use of medicines. They do not avoid place and persons infected by the plague. They lightheartedly make sport of it, and they wish to prove how independent they are. And he said, both of these things are a blight on the church in times of emergency. And we want to, as the leadership of the church, Pastor you all, whatever category you may fit in, hopefully somewhere in between, in how we might proceed by not being reckless as a congregation, but also being as faithful as we can be, both to you in your need for spiritual comfort in the midst of a trying time, but also to our community at large. So today, you know, we're holding church for that reason. And my hope is that this well-known psalm can help direct us in the midst of at least a current trial. So the first thing I want us to see in Psalm 121 is the world is a dangerous place. The world is a dangerous place. And it begins, you'll notice in the psalm, with a questioning pilgrim. You'll notice the tenses change in Psalm 121. There's the first person in the first two verses. He's speaking in the first person singular. You know, I lift my eyes up to the hill. Where does my help come from? And then by the time you get to verse 3, there's a shift. Someone's answering his question. There's this, you know, questioning pilgrim, and then there's someone from the outside answering the question of the pilgrim. And what we see in this question of the pilgrim is that the world is dangerous. You know, he's about to begin a departure. This is a pilgrimage psalm. It's written, you know, for the times that they would make their annual pilgrimage to Jerusalem to worship at the temple. And as he departs, he begins by looking to the mountains. And if you will, you know, Jerusalem's always pictured for us as being on a mountain. He's headed toward this mountain and he's looking up to that mountain and those that surround it, saying, you know, where does my help come from? He's about to leave on a journey that ends at God's house. And he's concerned about the help that he will need to get there. I mean, why does he need help at all? Because there are dangers built into the endeavor on which he sets out. I mean, dangers that await him on this particular journey. And I think in times like the present, we begin to realize what is always true but is often hidden. That life is always dangerous. Times like this bring that to the fore, but the fact is, you know, people die in car accidents every day and annually by the thousands. Terminal illness is diagnosed daily for those who are unexpecting when the diagnosis came. Financial ruin comes every day to some households in this nation. But a pandemic, of course, makes us remember what is always true, that the world is a dangerous place, that there is no certainty built into this life, that things in one sense are always uncertain. It's just this mirage of certainty that comes with the comforts of suburban living. That, you know, there aren't things that are always before our face that appear, at least anyway, to be dangerous. Well, on this particular journey for the psalmist, there's these physical dangers that are all around him. You know, physical dangers that are inherent on a road trip, and especially if you're on a road trip by foot, or at least on beast of burden is the best case scenario for this guy. He's exposed to physical dangers. He's going to be passing over mountains, descending down steep paths. There'll be long stretches where he'll be exposed to the elements, whether the scorching of the sun during the daytime, the potentials of rain, and of course the cold of night. There are wild animals that he will face. There are bandits, at least as a threat, who will prey on his situation and exposure. There's the reality of limited resources. And again, you've got to get yourself a bit into the mind of this psalm. You know, he has got to take with him, most likely, the supplies that he needs for the road. And so that's fine. He probably has some sort of food stores that he can bring. But of course, when you're hiking, the big question is always water. You know, where will be the next place we can go to get water? Because you can only carry so much. And of course, this is before Nalgene's and Camelbacks. You know, they had literal camelbacks, but not the kind that we take hiking. And so there would only be so much they could take on their as they set out for their journey, and they would need, Lord willing, to come across water on the way. We often don't think about how serious this was. I mean, not only are all these potentialities out there, if one of these things does come to pass for them, there is no ambulance, there is no hospital, they're not going to get their cell phone out and call somebody, there's no police at the ready to take their written report if a bandit robs them along the way. There's no Costco to hit up if they run out of supplies. And think of it, I mean, they didn't even have toilet paper, much less, you know, need to get huge stores of it. They were really dependent. What I mean by that is every time they set out, they knew that they were dependent. God had to go before them and protect their way. The realities that we all encounter, but we rarely bring to the fore of our mind because things seem, again, so automatic at times and so safe. Times like this help us to remember what is always true, but the modern life often masks. We are dependent people too. And the question is, what happens if supplies run out? What happens if there are no hospitals to go to? What happens if people turn violent in order to meet their own needs? These are the dangers of the psalm, and these are, of course, the potentialities that face us. The danger of life is always real. And in times of plague and famine and natural disaster, we're reminded of what is always true. We are frail, we are needy, and we are dependent, no matter how many times we've told ourselves the opposite. Well, if that is true, if we are dependent, the natural question is, who will help me? Which is the question the psalmist is asking. Where does my help come from? Who's going to help me along the way? And as soon as we see the nature of the question, we also realize the nature of the threat. While it appears to be primarily a physical danger that the psalmist is concerned about, the concern runs us headfirst into the spiritual dangers of life. This is no less true for your situation, dear church. Our present threat nationally is physical and it's real. But you'll see it's just as spiritual as it is physical. Because as soon as a problem presents itself, where you go for your resource to solve it is a spiritual reality. Or at least it has a spiritual source. Spiritual dangers of one who one turns to in time of need, where will you get your help from, is the question of the psalm, but also the question of our life. And as he begins, he looks up and he asks the question on the road in the midst of danger, where will my help come from? He says, I lift my eyes to the hills. It's interesting that scripturally speaking, this is used time and again for what one does when he's about to worship idols. Ezekiel 18, he does not eat upon the mountains, nor does he lift his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel. Again, he says, I lift my eyes to the mountains. Well, the mountains are often where the false gods live, the high places. And so when the psalmist is saying, I lift my eyes to the hills, he's asking a question, of which one of these gods will I go to for help in my time of need? Where is my resource? And again, that may sound foreign to us, but we are here in this text along with the psalmist, no doubt. We are on the road to God's house, journeying even now. And as dangers present themselves, anxieties rise, uncertainties abound, and you will have to ask yourself the question, where do you get your help? Where is your resource? This is why, again, times of heightened concern can be of spiritual help to us, because they reveal the emptiness of all other help, and they also reveal where we've been putting our stock up until now. You know, if we're depending on our mutual funds for security, the last couple of weeks show that's a very up and down endeavor. Meaning, it's not wholly predictable. It's not dependable. It may make for a wise strategy, but it makes for a terrible God. Depending on your creature comforts, the things that are, you know, right up the road, conveniently available at your nearest retail outlet, and if they don't have them, you can always go on Amazon. You have found out this week that there are not infinite pools of resource, and that they can run out too. Again, things that we just don't normally have to consider. If depending on your routine, your diet, your political party, your good neighborhood is where your resource is, you'll find that disease does not discriminate. It doesn't care if you're upper middle class or if you have a good job or what kind of degrees you hold. Your able body is not a guaranteed resource, quite opposite, in fact. It's not a matter of if, of course, just when. Going anywhere for true comfort and rest other than God Himself is the very heart of idolatry. And so while we may not be, you know, hiking up the hills to go bow down before stumps, we may be slumped over our phone screen checking the latest update, finding the latest mark of the Dow Jones, seeing how many steps and our calorie count, and finding out how many likes have transpired. It can be the very same thing. And from those, you know, who would be looking from the time of the writing of the psalm, seeing us doing it, it would look just as strange as we would think them bowing down before a stump would look. So where does your help come from? And that is the question of the text, the question of our current pandemic, the question of life itself at its very core. Well, if we have the questioning pilgrim, you know, we also have the confessing pilgrim in verse 2. My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. One of the things that comforts me about this particular psalm is that the one questioning is a confessor. But, you know, this is one who believes in the God of Israel, and that doesn't keep him from being very afraid and anxious and wondering where his source of help is. He believes, but he struggles with anxieties. This isn't someone who doesn't know their theology. They're about to make that plain, but one who knows it and still struggles to believe it, at least wholly. One who is saved, but scared. He's a believer, but also a doubter. He's a saint, but also a sinner. And his confession is, my help comes from Yahweh. You'll notice he uses that covenant name of God, the name that was given as God gave himself to his people, the I am there for you name of God that was given specially to Israel. Our pilgrim begins to rehearse his belief. He who has helped me before, Yahweh, in delivering his people from things like plagues and enemies and travel and drought and famine, he got his people safely to his house in the promised land. That's the one I'm going to look to for help. And notice, Yahweh is a helper and a redeemer. That word, where does my help come from, is often used in military terms in Scripture, that God comes as a help or a rescue to fight on the behalf of his people. You know, Moses says, as he names one of his sons Eliezer, he says, my father's God was a helper. He delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. So notice, he's a helper in that he's one that comes to rescue and deliver and to fight on behalf of his people. So the Lord of the Exodus, the God of our fathers, the God of promise, the one who overturned Pharaoh and all his false gods, the God who preserved his people in the midst of all the plagues that fell upon the nation of Egypt, the God who provided all along their exodus and the journey that took all of those years, and thus proved he was greater than all the other gods and all of the other hills, but he also proved that he was for Israel specifically. He was for us. He did all of this for us. He's our Redeemer, God. But notice what he confesses next. My help comes from Yahweh, this personal God who helps us specifically. But that personal God who helps them specifically, the covenant God, also is the Creator. He made heaven and earth. The one who is on our side owns all of it, controls all of it, oversees all of it. The one who is at the top of the food chain of all of the other gods out there, who made all of the paths that this pilgrim will travel. You know, as he looks to all the other hills and sees the God of the moon and the God of rain and the God, you know, he realizes Yahweh is the maker of it all. And therefore, the changing scenes of life, like the ones we're experiencing presently, don't change the sovereignty of God one iota. That He's still the maker of all things, and therefore we can depend on Him and know that He is in control of everything that is coming to pass. This confession affirms the power of God when related to the impotence of these other hill-dwelling gods. In this pilgrim's confession, he acknowledges the God of his father who has helped and delivered in the past and is able to help even in the present. This God is his hope. But his fears are still real. I don't know if you've met anyone that has a life like that, where they believe in God, but they still have all these other anxieties. They're even Calvinists, and they get nervous about things. I've met a couple, none here. But that is what we have in this text, a believer who still is anxious. But notice it's not just the fact that the world is a dangerous place. We have this person responding to the pilgrim, and we learn that God, if you can handle the language, is our safe space. That's biblical language, refuge. God is our safe space. In verses 3 to 8, you'll notice this new voice chimes in from outside of the pilgrim, confirming his faith, assuring him, and blessing him. The pilgrim is believing but troubled, and this voice comes to him from the outside to help him in his weakness. If the speaker is not a priest, he surely functions as one. And it's hard not to hear the Aaronic overtones in verses 7 and 8, the Lord bless you and keep you sort of language that's found there. I mean, this very fact, what you're about to see in this psalm, is the whole reason that we're gathered here this morning. To hear a voice from the outside bolster our weak faith. To say, as we come, we know we believe these things, we confess these things, but the whole goal of preaching, the whole point of word and sacrament has to have something from the outside to come to in your weakness and bring you the comfort that you cannot afford yourself. That for whatever reason, we just can't drum it up in ourselves. And God is merciful to come to us in these meetings as we gather together in His name and to speak to us from that outside voice. First thing we see in this point that God is our safe space in verses 3 and 4 is that Yahweh guards all day. Notice He says He won't let your foot slip. And obviously He's on a walk, and this can literally happen as they go through dangerous places. I'm sure if you've ever hiked any kind of serious mountains or rock climbing, you realize that the treachery of it sometimes. God says to them, I'm here. I'm not going to let your foot literally slip. But of course, metaphorically, this sort of language is all over the Psalms. My feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. But God comes and doesn't allow him to slip into that particular transgression, spiritual slipping. He didn't let him fall into sin or stumble along the way. He says, you do not let my foot slip, you will not sleep. Three times in this psalm, the pilgrim is assured that Yahweh keeps a sleepless vigil, that he's always awake. Now again, this isn't stuff that normally concerns us, but this one who is on guard, this one who is here to help you, to fight for you, he never falls asleep. His eyes are always open. There's no threat that's going to come upon him in his weakness. I'm sure you've seen the movies, whether it be, a real war movie or a comedy, whoever's keeping night watch, the dangerous thing happens when? When they've nodded off to sleep and someone finally gets past the lines where it says, God's there defending you and he never falls asleep. It's not something that concerns him. God stands guard so they can feel secure. And therefore, he gives his beloved sleep because he is always on watch, because he is never anxious, because he is concerned for you. He allows you, if by faith you will take it, to be unconcerned in that way. To go to bed and not have to stay up, at 3 in the morning worrying about what's going to happen next. So he guards us all day, but notice he also guards in verses 5 and 6 in all ways. Says, his right hand, he's the shade at your right hand. The right hand, again, in the Psalms is a place of protection, or actually is a place of weakness on the opponent's side, meaning if your shield's in your left hand, the spot that is susceptible for you to get injured is on your right side. And so it's okay, because God is standing at your right hand. So you don't have to worry about the exposure of your weak side. It's, the way we use it in common parlance now is, I've got your back. Why do people say that? Well, because that's where someone's going to come and, thump you in the back of the head. But if they're, if they're keeping watch for you on that side, you're not endangered. And God is saying he's there at your right side. It says the sun, won't do damage by day or the moon by night. So day and night, there are enemies and potential threats. And obviously, on a walk like this, the sun is a physical threat, whether it be sunstroke and so forth. And the moon speaks of the dangers that come out at night, whether it be the wild beast or robbers and so forth. But also, scripturally speaking, the realities of that is where anxieties and terrors and aberrations take place. The things that keep you up at night, right? Those odd thoughts that seem so large in the darkness of the night that when thought about either the previous day or the next day don't seem nearly as big. There is God protecting us. God is saying that whatever befalls you, whatever is at your left or at your right, He is there. If you're physically threatened health-wise from the sun, He's with you. If you're mentally threatened by the moon, God won't desert you. Whatever the circumstances, enemies without, personal and physical enemies within, your own spiritual issues and your own mental anguish, God is there guarding you, whether you perceive it or not. So God guards in all ways, or Yahweh guards in all ways. And notice, in verses 7 and 8, He guards the whole way. He says He keeps you from all harm. He watches over your life. It's all encompassing. It's all lifelong. It's not that He's like really vigilant for 2 weeks a year and then He just goes on vacation. Or it's like He's really good at this time of day and there's other parts where He's not. He says, no, from beginning to end, from the very your birth to the end of your existence, there is God plodding along with you, making sure that you are overseen. Nothing is outside of His care. It says you're going out and you're coming in. Every possible circumstance, the entirety of this man's pilgrimage, God will journey with you wherever you go, and He will march back with you as well. They will journey to this holy place and they will return home. And the psalmist is saying, it's not just on your journey to give your gifts to God that He's going to watch you. Even when you return back to the mundane things of life, your normal existence, there God will be as well. That's true of us. And God really is our refuge, our safe space, our ever-present help in time of trouble. And that is, at the end of the day, beloved, our comfort in times like these. Our comfort isn't knowing exactly what's going to happen, because we don't. Our comfort is knowing who is there in the midst of whatever is happening. And the psalmist says, God is your ever-present help in time of trouble. This God who is the same yesterday and today and forever is with us in the midst of this journey. But how can we know that? Since we can't always sense that. It doesn't always feel like God is with us. I mean, obviously this hasn't ravaged our area yet, not in a way that it could. But surely when these sorts of things break out, the question of where is God becomes a real question. And sensing His presence becomes a whole lot more difficult. So how can we know this is true even when we don't sense that it's true? And our final point this morning is because we have God in a world of danger. And I mean it in this way. The key to this psalm is the speaker. This one who is answering the questions of this dear pilgrim. The one who is here this morning answering our questions. In the priestly voice of the experienced and the confident pilgrim, Jesus speaks to us from this text and can be heard. I mean, as we cry out concerning our need for help and what is the source of our help, Christ's voice comes clearly through. He is the second voice of this text. He knows this road that we're on because He's taken it. He's walked this particular journey before. He's experienced the scorching sun of the wilderness of this world, and all of course culminating for Him on the cross. He knows how distant the Father seems at times, even as He cried out in that cry of dereliction. He knows the threats of pilgrimage. Even as we read in Hebrews, Christ didn't come into this world in human flesh and remain untouched by the things that can harm us in this life. He underwent the very pains of this existence. And even as the psalmist will talk about it in other psalms, you know, it speaks of his time on earth as being surrounded by ravenous and wild animals, all seeking his life. But God delivered him from all of those threats. And the psalmist, in speaking of that deliverance, says in Psalm 22, a psalm that we all know is on the lips of our Lord, "I will declare your name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly. I will praise you." The very verse that the author of Hebrews uses when he's explaining that Christ is here being merciful to those who all life long have been scared to death of death. And it says, you can hear his voice even in the singing of the assembly. Christ is there singing louder than everyone, saying, "I want to declare the name of God in the midst of the assembly. I will put my trust in him." Why does he say that? He said, "Because I was surrounded by wolves. I was brought under the fiercest of temptations. I was given the most excruciating pains of this life. And what I found at the end of it was a God of resurrection who is always faithful. And I will say to my brethren, put your trust in him." That Christ is speaking in the psalm, that drumbeat of "he guards, he guards, he guards." He's saying it to us because he's lived it and he sees how the story ends. You know, we all know that Christ is not currently concerned about whether he will experience the coronavirus, because he's resurrected, ascended, enthroned. His work is over. Because he's seen how the faithfulness of God ends. And therefore, he's speaking to us an experience that we have not had yet, but he's telling us, you can depend on God now in the midst of this journey, because I've been in the midst of it, experienced all that this dangerous world had to offer. And I see that the God of Scriptures, the covenant God, is faithful to his children. And therefore, dear people of God, as we experience this current crisis, as it is one in many places and as it may become one, our assurance is not that dangerous things won't happen or that bad things won't come upon us. Our assurance is that God will guard all day long, in every possible situation, the entirety of our life, even through death. His faithfulness does not end. So may we put our hope in him this morning. Let us pray.